Hello, my name is Neil Donald Walsh. What you're about to hear is a portion of a 6-year dialogue which makes up a trilogy I've called Conversations with God. This program contains material from the third volume of that trilogy and touches on subjects such as reincarnation, death, suicide, the chakras, sexual energies, and meditation as a path to heightened awareness. Also in this volume is a deep discussion of marriage and what I consider to be one of the most amazing revelations in the trilogy, the true nature of the soul. Now, if you're coming to the Conversations with God material for the first time, a brief explanation may be in order here. In 1992, I'd reached a low point in my life. Nothing was working. My relationships were falling apart. My career was coming to a dead end. Even my health was failing. In anguished despair, I called out to God, begging for answers to the questions which plague all of us at moments like this. What does it take to make life work? And what had I done to deserve a life of such continuing struggle? One night, I awoke in a fit of anger and wrote all these questions down on a yellow legal pad. And to my astonishment, even as I wrote them, I began to receive answers. I found my pen moving effortlessly across the page as I wrote out the thoughts being given to me by what I can only describe as a voiceless voice. I was receiving answers to my questions, and all I had to do was take dictation. And this I did, intermittently for 6 years, engaging in an ongoing dialogue covering an extraordinary range of topics. For once I started receiving answers, I did not stop asking questions. And this program is an audio presentation of a portion of that material. Because I received this dictation from a voiceless voice, that is, a voice having neither male nor female characteristics, it was important to me that the words of God on the audio program be assigned to both a man and a woman, so that the voice would not be gender-specific. I want to thank Edward Asner and Ellen Burstyn for reading this material with me and making it come alive.
I know that you are all seeking to evolve, to grow spiritually, to return to the oneness. You are seeking
to experience yourself as the grandest version of the greatest vision you ever had about who you are. You are seeking this individually and as a race. Now there are no rights and wrongs, no do's and don'ts in my world, as I have said many times. And you do not burn in the everlasting fires of hell if you make a bad choice, because neither bad nor hell exists, unless, of course, you think that it does. Still, there are natural laws that have been built into the physical universe. And one of those is the law of cause and effect. One of the most important laws of cause and effect is this. All caused effect is ultimately experienced by the self.
What does that mean?
Whatever you cause another to experience, you will one day experience. Members of your New Age community have a more colorful way of putting it.
What goes around comes around.
Right. Others know this as the Jesus injunction. Do unto others as you would have it done unto you. Jesus was teaching the law of cause and effect. It is what might be called the prime law. Somewhat like the prime directive given to Kirk, Picard, and Janeway.
Hey, God is a Trekkie.
Are you kidding? I wrote half the episodes.
So. Better not let Gene hear you say that.
Come on. Gene told me to say that.
You were in touch with Gene Roddenberry?
And Carl Sagan, and Bob Heinlein, and the whole gang up here.
You know, we shouldn't get around like this. It takes away from the believability of the whole dialogue.
I see. A conversation with God has to be serious.
Well, at least believable.
It's not believable that I've got Gene, Carl, and Bob right here?
Well,
I'll have to tell them that. Well, back to how you can tell a true psychic from a fake one. A true psychic knows and lives the prime directive. That's why if you ask her to bring back a long-lost love or read the aura of another person whose handkerchief or letter you have, a true psychic will tell you, I'm sorry, but I won't do that. I will never interfere with, intervene in, or look in on the path walked by another. I will not attempt to affect, direct, or impact their choices in any way. And I will not divulge to you information about any individual that is personal or private. If a person offers to perform one of these services for you, that person is what you would call a shyster, using your own human weaknesses and vulnerabilities to extract money from you.
But what about psychics who help people locate a missing loved one? A child who was abducted, a teenager who ran away and has too much pride to call home, even though they desperately want to. Or how about the classic case of locating a person, dead or alive, for the police?
Of course. These questions all answer themselves. What the true psychic always avoids is imposing his will upon another. She is there only to serve.
Is it okay to ask a psychic to contact the dead? Should we attempt to reach out to those who have gone before?
Why would you want to?
Well, to see if they have something they want to say to us, to tell us.
If somebody from the other side has something they want you to know, they'll find a way to cause you to know it. Don't worry. The aunt, the uncle, the brother, the sister, the father, the mother, the spouse, and lover who have gone before are continuing their own journey, experiencing complete joy, moving toward total understanding. If part of what they want to do is to come back to you, to see how you are, to bring you an awareness that they're all right, whatever, trust that they'll do that. Then watch for the sign and catch it. Don't dismiss it as just your imagination, wishful thinking, or coincidence. Watch for the message and receive it.
I know a lady who was nursing her dying husband, and she begged him, if he had to go, please come back to her and let her know that he was all right. Well, he promised he would and died 2 days later. Not a week went by when the lady was awakened one night by the feeling that someone had just sat down on the bed beside her. When she opened her eyes, she could have sworn she saw her husband sitting at the foot of the bed, smiling at her. But when she blinked and looked again, he was gone. She told me this story later, saying then that she must have been hallucinating.
Yes, that's very common. You receive signs, irrefutable, obvious signs, and you ignore them, or dismiss them as your own mind playing tricks on you. You have the same choice now with this book.
Why do we do that? Why do we ask for something like the wisdom contained in these three books, then refuse to believe it when we receive it?
Because you doubt the greater glory of God.
Because you what?
Because you doubt the greater glory of God. Capisce?
I got it.
Like Thomas, you have to see, feel, touch before you will believe. Yet that which you wish to know cannot be seen, felt, or touched. It is of another realm, and you are not open to that. You are not ready. Yet do not fret. When the student is ready, the teacher will appear.
So, you're saying then, to get back to the original line of questioning, that we should not go to a psychic or a seance seeking to contact those on the other side.
I'm not saying that you should or shouldn't do anything. I'm just not sure what the point would be.
Well, supposing you had something you wanted to say to the other rather than something you wanted to hear from them.
Do you imagine that you could say it and they not hear it? The slightest thought having to do with the being existing on what you call the other side brings that being's consciousness flying to you. You cannot have a thought or an idea about a person who is what you call deceased without that person's essence becoming completely aware of it. It is not necessary to use a medium to produce such communication. Love is the best medium of communication.
But how about two-way communication? Would a medium be helpful there, or is such communication even possible? Is it all hogwash? Is it dangerous?
You are talking now about communication with spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, such communication is possible. Is it dangerous? Virtually everything is dangerous if you are afraid. What you fear, you create. Yet there is really nothing to be afraid of. Loved ones are never far from you, never more than a thought away. They will always be there if you need them, ready with counsel or comfort or advice. If there's a high level of stress on your part about a loved one being okay, they will send you a sign, a signal, a little message that will allow you to know everything's fine. You won't even have to call on them because souls who loved you in this life are drawn to you, pulled to you, fly to you the moment they sense the slightest trouble or disturbance in your auric field. One of their first opportunities as they learn about the possibilities of their new existence is to provide aid and comfort to those they love, and you will feel their comforting presence if you are really open to them.
So, the stories we hear of people who could have sworn that a deceased loved one was in the room could be true.
Most assuredly. One might smell the loved one's perfume or cologne, or get a whiff of the cigar they smoked, or faintly hear a song they used to hum. Or out of nowhere, some personal possession of theirs may suddenly appear. A handkerchief, or a wallet, or some cufflink, or piece of jewelry just shows up for no reason. It's found in a chair cushion, or under a stack of old magazines. There it is. A picture. A photograph. Of a special moment, just when you were missing that person and thinking about them and feeling sad about their death. These things don't just happen. These kinds of things don't just appear at just the right moment by chance. I tell you this, there are no coincidences in the universe. This is very common, very common. Now back to your question. Do you need a so-called medium or channel to communicate with beings out of the body? No. Is it sometimes helpful? Sometimes. So much depends again on the psychic or medium and on their motivation. If someone refuses to work in this way with you, or to do any kind of channeling or go-between work without high compensation, run. Don't walk the other way. That person may be in it only for the money. Don't be surprised if you get hooked into returning time and time again for weeks or months or even years as they play on your need or desire for contact with the spirit world. A person who is only there, as the spirit is there, to help, asks nothing for himself except what is needed to continue to do the work they seek to do. If a psychic or medium is coming from that place when she agrees to help you, make sure you offer all the help in return that you can. Don't take advantage of such extraordinary generosity of the spirit by giving little or not at all when you know you could do more. Look to see who is truly serving the world, truly seeking to share wisdom and knowledge, insight and understanding, caring and compassion. Provide for those people, and provide grandly. Pay them the highest honor. Give them the largest amount, for these are the bringers of the light.
Will you speak to me about reincarnation?
Sure.
Many religions say that reincarnation is a false doctrine, that we get only one life here, one chance.
I know. That is not accurate.
How can they be so wrong about something so important? How can they not know the truth about something so basic?
You must understand that humans have many fear-based religions whose teachings surround a doctrine of a God who is to be worshipped and feared. It was through fear that your entire Earth society reformed itself from the matriarchy to the patriarchy. It was through fear that the early priests got people to mend their wicked ways and heed the word of the Lord. It was through fear that churches gained and controlled their membership. One church even insisted that God would punish you if you did not go to church every Sunday. Not going to church was declared a sin, and not just any church. One had to attend one particular church. If you went to a church of a different denomination, that too was a sin. This was an attempt at control, pure and simple, using fear. The amazing thing is, it worked. Hell, it still works.
Say, you're God. Don't swear.
Who is swearing? I was making a statement of fact. I said, hell, it still works. People will always believe in hell and in a God who would send them there as long as they believe that God is like man, ruthless, self-serving, unforgiving, and vengeful. In days past, most people could not imagine a God who might rise above all of that. So they accepted the teaching of many churches to fear the terrible vengeance of the Lord. It was as if people couldn't trust themselves to be good, to act appropriately on their own for their own built-in reasons. So they had to create a religion that taught the doctrine of an angry, retributive God in order to keep themselves in line. Now, the idea of reincarnation threw a monkey wrench into all of that.
How so? What made that doctrine so threatening?
The church was proclaiming that you'd better be nice or else. And along came the reincarnationists saying, you'll have another chance after this, and another chance after that, and still more chances. So don't worry. Do the best you can. Don't become so paralyzed with fear that you can't budge. Promise yourself to do better and get on with it. Naturally, the early church couldn't hear of such a thing, so it did two things. First, it denounced the doctrine of reincarnation as heretical. Then it created the sacrament of confession. Confession could do for the churchgoer what reincarnation promised, that is, give him another chance.
So then we had a setup where God would punish you for your sins unless you confessed them. In that case, you could feel safe, knowing that God had heard your confession and had forgiven you.
Yes, but there was a catch.
Oh?
This absolution could not come directly from God. It had to flow through the church, whose priests pronounced penances which had to be performed. These were usually prayers which were required of the sinner. So now you had two reasons to keep up your membership. The church found confession to be such a good drawing card that soon it declared it to be a sin not to go to confession. Everybody had to do it at least once a year. If they didn't, God would have another reason to be angry. More and more rules, many of them arbitrary and capricious, began to be promulgated by the church, each rule having the power of God's eternal condemnation behind it, unless, of course, failure was confessed. Then the person was forgiven by God and condemnation avoided. But now there was another problem. People figured out that this must mean they could do anything, as long as they confessed it. The church was in a quandary. Fear had left the hearts of the people. Church attendance and membership dropped. People came to confess once a year, said their penances, were absolved of their sins, and went on with their lives. There was no question about it. A way had to be found to strike fear into the heart again. So, purgatory was invented.
Purgatory?
Purgatory. This was described as a place something like hell, but not eternal. This new doctrine declared that God would make you suffer for your sins, even if you confess them. Under the doctrine, a certain amount of suffering was decreed by God for each non-perfect soul based on the number and type of sins committed. There were mortal sins and venial sins. Mortal sins would send you right to hell if not confessed before death. Once more, church attendance shot up. Collections were up too, and especially contributions, for the doctrine of purgatory also included a way one could buy one's way out of the suffering.
I'm sorry?
According to the church's teaching, one could receive a special indulgence, but again, not directly from God, only from an official of the church. These special indulgences freed one from the suffering in purgatory, which they had earned with their sins, or at least part of it.
Something like time off for good behavior.
Yes, but of course these reprieves were granted to very few. Generally, those who made a conspicuous contribution to the church. For a really huge sum, one could obtain a plenary indulgence. This meant no time in purgatory at all. It was a non-stop ticket straight to heaven. This special favor from God was available for even fewer. Royalty, perhaps, and the super rich. The amount of money, jewels, and land given to the church in exchange for these plenary indulgences was enormous. But the exclusivity of all this brought great frustration and resentment to the masses. No pun intended. The poorest peasant hadn't a hope of gaining a bishop's indulgence, and so the rank and file lost faith in the system, with attendance threatening to drop once again.
Well, now what did they do?
They brought in the novena candles. People could come to the church and light a novena candle for the poor souls in purgatory, and by saying a novena, a series of prayers in a particular order that took some time to complete, they could knock years off the sentence of the dearly departed, extricating them from purgatory sooner than God would otherwise have allowed. They couldn't do anything for themselves, but at least they could pray for mercy for the departed. Of course, it would be helpful if a coin or two were dropped through the slot for each candle lit. A lot of little candles were flickering behind a lot of red glass, and a lot of pesos and pennies were being dropped into a lot of tin boxes in an attempt to get me to ease up on the suffering being inflicted on the souls in purgatory.
Wow, man, this is unbelievable. And you mean people could not see right through all that? People didn't see it as the desperate attempt of a desperate church to keep its members desperate to do anything to protect themselves from this desperado they call God? You mean people actually bought this stuff?
Quite literally.
Huh. No wonder the church declared reincarnation to be an untruth.
Yes. Yet when I created you, I did not create you so that you could live one lifetime, an infinitesimal period, really, given the age of the universe, make the mistakes you are inevitably going to make, then hope for the best at the end. I've tried to imagine setting it up that way, but I can never figure out what my purpose would be. You could never figure it out either. That's why you've had to keep saying things like, the Lord works in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't work in mysterious ways. Everything I do has a reason, and it's perfectly clear. I've explained why I created you and the purpose of your life many times now during this trilogy. Reincarnation fits perfectly into that purpose, which is for me to create and experience who I am through you, lifetime after lifetime, and through the millions of other creatures of consciousness I have placed in the universe.
Well, then there is life on other
planets. Of course there is. Do you really believe that you are alone in this gigantic universe? But that's another topic we can get to later.
Promise?
Promise.
Okay.
So your purpose as a soul is to experience yourself as all of it. We are evolving. We are becoming. Becoming what? We do not know. We cannot know until we get there. But for us, the journey is the joy. And as soon as we get there, as soon as we create the next highest idea of who we are, we'll create a grander thought, a higher idea, and continue the joy forever. Are you with me here?
Yes. And by this time, I almost could repeat this verbatim.
Good. So the point and purpose of your life is to decide and to be who you really are. You're doing that every day.
With every action, with every thought, with every word, that's what you're doing. Now, to the degree that you're pleased with that, pleased with who you are in your experience, to that degree you'll stick more or less with the creation, making only minor adjustments here and there to get it closer and closer to perfect. Paramahansa Yogananda is an example of a person who was very close to perfect as an out-picturing of what he thought of himself. He had a very clear idea about himself and about his relationship to me, and he used his life to outpicture that. He wanted to experience his idea about himself in his own reality, to know himself as that, experientially. Babe Ruth did the same thing. He had a very clear idea about himself and his relationship to me, and he used his life to outpicture that, to know himself in his own experience. Not many people live that level. Now, granted, the master and the babe had two entirely different ideas about themselves, yet they both played them out magnificently. They also both had different ideas about me, that's for sure, and were coming from different levels of consciousness about who I am and about their true relationship to me. And those levels of consciousness were reflected in their thoughts, words, and actions. One was in a place of peace and serenity most of his life and brought deep peace and serenity to others. The other was in a place of anxiousness, turmoil, and occasional anger, particularly when he couldn't get his way, and brought turmoil to the lives of those around him. Both were good-hearted, however. There was never a softer touch than the babe. And the difference between the two is that one had virtually nothing in terms of physical acquisitions, but never wanted more than what he got, while the other had everything and never got what he really wanted. If that were the end of it for George Herman, I suppose we could all feel a little sad about that. But the soul that embodied itself as Babe Ruth is far from finished with this process called evolution. It has had an opportunity to review the experiences it produced for itself, as well as the experiences it produced for others, and now gets to decide what next it would like to experience as it seeks to create and recreate itself in grander and grander versions. We'll drop our narrative regarding these two souls here because both have already made their next choice regarding what they want to now experience. And in fact, both are now experiencing that.
You mean both have already reincarnated into other bodies?
It would be a mistake to assume that reincarnating, returning to another physical body, was the only option open to them.
Well, what are the other options?
In truth, whatever they want them to be. I've already explained here what occurs after what you called your death. Some souls feel that there's a lot more they would like to know, and so they find themselves going to a school, whereas other souls, what you call old souls, teach them. And what do they teach them? That they have nothing to learn. That they never had anything to learn. That all they ever had to do was remember. Remember who and what they really are. They are taught that the experience of who they are is gained in the acting out of it, in being it. They are reminded of this by having it gently shown to them. Other souls have already remembered this by the time they get to, or soon after they get to, the other side. I'm using language now with which you are familiar, speaking in your vernacular, to keep as much as possible the words out of the way. These souls may then seek the immediate joy of experiencing themselves as whatever they wish to be. They may select from the million, kajillion aspects of me and choose to experience that right then and there. Some may opt to return to physical form to do that.
Any physical form?
Any.
Then it's true that souls could return as animals, that God could be a cow, and that cows really are sacred. Holy cow. Sorry.
You've had a whole lifetime to do stand-up comedy.
Well.
By the way, looking at your life, you've done a pretty good job of it.
Chaboom! That was a rim shot. If I had a cymbal here, I'd give you a cymbal crash.
Thank you. But seriously, folks. The answer to the question you are basically asking, can a soul return as an animal, is yes, of course. The real question is, would it? The answer is probably not.
Do animals have souls?
Anyone who has ever stared into the eyes of an animal already knows the answer to that.
Then how do I know it is not my grandmother come back as my cat?
The process we are discussing here is evolution. Self-creation and evolution. And evolution proceeds one way, upward, ever upward. The soul's greatest desire is to experience higher and higher aspects of itself. And so it seeks to move upward, not downward, on the evolutionary scale, until it experiences what has been called nirvana, total oneness with the all, that is, with me.
But if the soul desires higher and higher experiences of itself, why would it even bother returning as a human being? Surely that can't be a step upward.
If the soul returns to human form, it is always in an effort to further experience, and thus further evolve. There are many levels of evolution observable and demonstrated in humans. One could come back for many lifetimes, many hundreds of lifetimes, and continue to evolve upward. Yet upward movement, the grandest desire of the soul, is not achieved with return to a lower life form. Thus, such a return does not occur. Not until the soul reaches ultimate reunion with all that is.
Well, that must mean there are new souls coming into the system every day, taking lower life forms.
No. Every soul that was ever created was created at once. We are all here, now. But as I've explained before, when a soul, a part of me, reaches ultimate realization, it has the option to start over, to literally forget everything. So that it can remember all over again and recreate itself anew once more. In this way, God continues to re-experience itself. Souls may also choose to recycle through a particular life form at a particular level as often as they like. Without reincarnation, without the ability to return to a physical form, The soul would have to accomplish everything it seeks to accomplish within one lifetime, which is 1 billion times shorter than the blink of an eye on the cosmic clock. So yes, of course, reincarnation is a fact. It's real, it's purposeful, and it's perfect.
Okay, but there's one thing I'm confused about. You said there is no such thing as time, that all things are happening right now. Is that correct?
It is.
And then you implied, and in book two you went into depth on this, that we exist all the time on different levels or at various points in the space-time continuum.
That's true.
Okay, so now here's where it gets crazy. If one of the me's on the space-time continuum dies, then comes back here as another person, then who am I? I would have to be existing as two people at once. And if I kept on doing this through all eternity, which you say I do, then I'm being 100 people at once, 1,000, 1,000,000. 1,000,000 versions of 1,000,000 people at 1,000,000 points on the space-time continuum.
Yes.
Oh, I don't understand that. My mind can't grasp that.
Actually, you've done well. It's a very advanced concept, and you've done pretty well with it.
But if that's true, then I, the part of me that is immortal, must be evolving in 1,000,000,000 different ways, in 1,000,000,000 different forms, at 1,000,000,000 different points on the cosmic wheel in the eternal moment of now.
Right again. That's exactly what I'm doing.
No. I said that's what I must be doing.
Right again. That's just what I said.
No. I said...
I know what you said. You said just what I said you said. The confusion here is that you still think there's more than one of us here.
There's not.
There was never more than one of us here, ever. Are you just finding that out?
You mean I've just been talking to myself here?
Something like that.
You mean you're not God?
That's not what I said.
You mean you are God?
That's what I said.
But if you're God, and you're me, and I'm you, then I'm God.
Thou art God. Yes, that is correct. You grok it in fullness.
But I'm not only God. I'm also everyone else.
Yes.
But does that mean that no one and nothing else exists but me?
Have I not said I and my Father are one?
Yes, but...
And have I not said we are all one?
Yes, but I didn't know you meant that literally. I thought you meant that figuratively. I thought it was more of a philosophical statement, not a statement of fact.
It's a statement of fact. We are all one. That is what is meant by whatsoever ye do unto the least of these, ye do unto me. Do you understand now?
Yes.
No. At last. At long last.
But, and you'll forgive me for arguing this, but when I'm with another, my spouse, for instance, or my children, it feels that I am separate from them, that they are other than me.
Consciousness is a marvelous thing. It can be divided into 1,000 pieces, 1,000,000, 1,000,000 times 1,000,000. I've divided myself into an infinite number of pieces so that each piece of me could look back on itself and behold the wonder of who and what I am.
But why do I have to go through this period of forgetfulness, of disbelief? I'm still not totally believing. I'm still hanging out in forgetfulness.
Don't be so hard on yourself. That's part of the process. It's okay that it's happening this way.
Well, then why are you telling me all this now?
Because you were starting not to have fun. Life was beginning not to be a joy anymore. You were starting to get so caught up in the process that you forgot it was just a process. And so you called out to me. You asked me to come to you, to help you understand, to show you the divine truth, to reveal to you the greatest secret, the secret you've kept from yourself, the secret of who you are. Now I've done so. Now, once again, you've been caused to remember. Will it matter? Will it change how you act tomorrow? Will it cause you to see things differently tonight? Will you now heal the hurts of the wounded, quell the anxieties of the fearful, meet the needs of the impoverished, celebrate the magnificence of the accomplished, and see the vision of me everywhere? Will this latest remembrance of truth change your life and allow you to change the lives of others? Or will you return to forgetfulness, fall back into selfishness, revisit and reside again in the smallness of who you imagined yourself to be before this awakening? Which will it be?
Life really does go on forever and ever, doesn't it?
It most certainly does.
There's no end to it.
No end.
Reincarnation is a fact.
It is. You may return to mortal form, that is, the physical form, which can die whenever and however you wish.
Do we really decide when we want to come back?
If and when, yes.
Do we also decide when we want to leave? Do we choose when we want to die?
No experience is visited upon any soul against the soul's will. That is, by definition, not possible, since the soul is creating every experience. The soul wants nothing. The soul has everything, all wisdom, all knowing, all power, all glory. The soul is the part of you which never sleeps, never forgets. Does the soul desire that the body dies? No, it is the soul's desire that you never die. Yet the soul will leave the body, change its bodily form, leaving most of the material body behind at the drop of a hat, when it sees no purpose in remaining in that form.
If it's the soul's desire that we never die, why do we?
You don't. You merely change form.
Well, all right. If it's the soul's desire that we never do that, then why do we?
That is not the soul's desire. You are a shapeshifter. When there is no further usefulness in staying in a particular form, the soul changes form, willfully, voluntarily, joyfully, and moves on the cosmic wheel.
Joyfully?
With great joy.
You mean no soul dies regretfully?
No soul dies, ever.
I mean no soul has regrets that the current physical form is changing, is about to die.
The body never dies, but merely changes form with the soul. Yet I understand your meaning, so for now I use the vocabulary you have established. If you have a clear understanding of what you wish to create with regard to what you have chosen to call the afterlife, or if you have a clear set of beliefs that support an after-death experience of reuniting with God, then no, the soul never, ever has regrets over what you call death. Death in that instance is a glorious moment, a wonderful experience. Now the soul can return to its natural form, its normal state. There is an incredible lightness, a sense of total freedom, a limitlessness, and an awareness of oneness that is at once blissful and sublime. It is not possible for the soul to regret such a shift.
You're saying, then, that death is a happy experience?
For the soul that wishes it to be, yes, always.
Well, if the soul wants out of the body so bad, why doesn't it just leave it? Why is it hanging around?
I didn't say the soul wants out of the body. I said the soul is joyful when it is out. Those are two different things. You can be happy doing one thing and happy then doing another. The fact that you are joyful doing the second does not mean you are unhappy doing the first. The soul is not unhappy being with the body. Quite to the contrary. The soul is pleased to be you in your present form. That does not preclude the possibility that the soul might be equally pleased to be disconnected from it.
Well, there's obviously much about death I don't understand.
Yes, and that's because you don't like to think about it. Yet you must contemplate death and loss the instant you perceive any moment of life, or you will not have perceived life at all, but know only the half of it. Each moment ends the instant it begins. If you don't see this, you'll not see what is exquisite in it, and you will call the moment ordinary. Each interaction begins to end the instant it begins to begin. Only when this is truly contemplated and deeply understood does the full treasure of every moment and of life itself open to you. Life cannot give itself to you if you do not understand death. You must do more than understand it. You must love it, even as you love life. Your time with each person would be glorified if you thought it was your last time with that person. Your experience of each moment would be enhanced beyond measure if you thought it was the last such moment. Your refusal to contemplate your own death leads to your refusal to contemplate your own life. You don't see it for what it is. You miss the moment and all it holds for you. You look right past it instead of right through it. When you look deeply at something, you see right through it. To contemplate a thing deeply is to see right through it. Then the illusion ceases to exist. Then you see a thing for what it really is. Only then can you truly enjoy it, that is, place joy into it. To enjoy is to render something joyful. Even the illusion you can then enjoy, for you will know it is an illusion, and that is half the enjoyment. It is the fact that you think it is real that causes you all the pain. Nothing is painful which you understand is not real. Let me repeat that. Nothing is painful which you understand is not real. It's like a movie, a drama, played out on the stage of your mind. You are creating the situation and the characters. You are writing the lines. Nothing is painful the moment you understand that nothing is real. This is as true of death as it is of life. When you understand that death too is an illusion, then you can say, O death, where is thy sting? You can even enjoy death. You can even enjoy someone else's death. Does that seem strange? Does that seem a strange thing to say? Only if you do not understand death and life. Death is never an end, but always a beginning. A death is a door opening, not a door closing. When you understand that life is eternal, you understand that death is your illusion, keeping you very concerned with and therefore helping you believe that you are your body. Yet you are not your body, and so the destruction of your body is of no concern to you. Death should teach you that what is real is life, and life teaches you that what is unavoidable is not death, but impermanence. Impermanence is the only truth. Nothing is permanent. All is changing. In every instant, in every moment, were anything permanent, it could not be. For even the very concept of permanence depends upon impermanence to have any meaning. Therefore, even permanence is impermanent. Look at this deeply. Contemplate this truth. Comprehend it, and you comprehend God. This is the Dharma, and this is the Buddha. This is the Buddha Dharma. This is the teaching and the teacher. This is the lesson and the master. This is the object and the observer, rolled into one. They never have been other than one. It is you who have unrolled them so that your life may unroll before you. Yet as you watch your own life roll out before you, do not yourself become unraveled. Keep yourself together. See the illusion. Enjoy it, but do not become it. You are not the illusion, but the creator of it. You are in this world, but not of it. So use your illusion of death. Use it. Allow it to be the key that opens you to more of life. See the flower as dying, and you will see the flower sadly. Yet see the flower as part of a whole tree that is changing and will soon bear fruit, and you see the flower's true beauty. When you understand that the blossoming and the falling away of the flower is a sign that the tree is ready to bear fruit, then you understand life. Look at this carefully, and you will see that life is its own metaphor. Always remember, you are not the flower, nor are you even the fruit. You are the tree, and your roots are deep, embedded in me. I am the soil from which you have sprung, and both your blossoms and your fruit will return to me, creating more rich soil. Thus, life begets life, and cannot know death, ever.
That is so beautiful. That is so, so beautiful. Thank you. Will you speak to me now of something that is troubling me? I need to talk about suicide. Why is there such a taboo against the ending of one's life?
Indeed, why is there?
You mean it's not wrong to kill yourself?
The question cannot be answered to your satisfaction because the question itself contains two false concepts. It is based on two false assumptions. It contains two errors. The first false assumption is that there is such a thing as right and wrong. The second false assumption is that killing is possible. Your question itself, therefore, disintegrates the moment it is dissected. Right and wrong are philosophical polarities in a human value system which have nothing to do with ultimate reality, a point which I have made repeatedly throughout this dialogue. They are furthermore not even constant constructs within your own system, but rather values which keep shifting from time to time. You are doing the shifting, changing your mind about these values as it suits you, which rightly you should as evolving beings, yet insisting at each step along the way that you haven't done this, and that it is your unchanging values which form the core of your society's integrity. You've thus built your society on a paradox. You keep changing your values all the while proclaiming that it is unchanging values which you, well, value. The answer to the problem presented by this paradox is not to throw cold water on the sand in an attempt to make it concrete, but to celebrate the shifting of the sand. Celebrate its beauty while it holds itself in the shape of your castle, but then also celebrate the new form and shape it takes as the tide comes in. Celebrate the shifting sands as they form the new mountains you would climb, and atop which and with which you will build your new castles. Yet understand that these mountains and these castles are monuments to change, not to permanence. Glorify what you are today, yet do not condemn what you were yesterday, nor preclude what you could become tomorrow. Understand that right and wrong are figments of your imagination, and that okay and not okay are merely announcements of your latest preferences and imaginings. For example, in the question of ending one's life, it is the current imagining of the majority of people on your planet that it is not okay to do that. Similarly, many of you still insist that it is not okay to assist another who wishes to end his or her life. In both cases, you say this should be against the law. You've come to this conclusion, presumably, because the ending of the life occurs relatively quickly. Actions which end a life over a somewhat longer period of time are not against the law, even though they achieve the same result. Thus, if a person in your society kills himself with a gun, his family members lose insurance benefits. If he does so with cigarettes, they do not. If a doctor assists you in your suicide, it is called manslaughter. While if a tobacco company does, it's called commerce. With you, it seems to be merely a question of time. The legality of self-destruction, the rightness or wrongness of it, seems to have much to do with how quickly the deed is done, as well as who is doing it. The faster the death, the more wrong it seems to be. The slower the death, the more it slips into okayness. Interestingly, this is the exact opposite of what a truly humane society would conclude. By any reasonable definition of what you would call humane, the shorter the death, the better. Yet your society punishes those who would seek to do the humane thing and rewards those who would do the insane. It is insane to think that endless suffering is what God requires and that a quick, humane end to the suffering is wrong. Punish the humane, reward the insane. This is a motto which only a society of beings of limited understanding could embrace. So you poison your system by inhaling carcinogens. You poison your system by eating food treated with chemicals that over the long run kill you. And you poison your system by breathing air which you have continually polluted. You poison your system in 100 different ways over 1,000 different moments, and you do this knowing these substances are no good for you. But because it takes a longer time for them to kill you, you commit suicide with impunity. If you poison yourself with something that works faster, you are said to have done something against moral law. Now I tell you this. It is no more immoral to kill yourself quickly than it is to kill yourself slowly.
So a person who ends his own life is not punished by God?
I will not punish. I love.
What of the often heard statement that those who think they're going to escape their predicament or end their condition with suicide only find that they're facing the same predicament or condition in the afterlife, and therefore escaped and ended nothing?
Your experience of what you call the afterlife is a reflection of your consciousness at the time you enter it. Yet you are always a being of free will, and may alter your experience whenever you choose.
So loved ones who have ended their physical life are okay?
Yes, they are very okay.
There's a wonderful book on this subject called Stephen Lives by Ann Purrier. It's about her son who ended his life when he was a teenager. So many people have found it helpful.
Ann Purrier is a wonderful messenger, as is her son.
So you can recommend this book?
It is an important book. It says more on this subject than we are saying here. And those who have deep hurts or lingering issues surrounding the experience of a loved one ending their life will be open to healing through this book.
It is sad that we even have such deep hurts or issues. But much of that, I think, is a result of what our society has laid on us about suicide.
In your society, you often do not see the contradictions of your own moral constructions. The contradiction between doing things that you know full well are going to shorten your life, but doing them slowly, and doing things that will shorten your life quickly, is one of the most glaring in the human experience.
Yet they seem so obvious when you spell them out like this. Why can't we see such obvious truths on our own?
Because if you saw these truths, you would have to do something about them. This you do not wish to do, so you have no choice but to look right at something and not see it.
But why would we not want to do something about these truths if we saw them?
Because you believe that in order to do something about them, you would have to end your pleasures. And ending pleasures is something you have no desire to do. Most of the things which cause your slow deaths are things which bring you pleasure or result from those things. And most of the things which bring you pleasure are things which satisfy the body. Indeed, this is what marks yours as a primitive society. Your lives are structured largely around seeking and experiencing pleasures of the body. Of course, all beings everywhere seek to experience pleasures. There's nothing primitive in that. In fact, it is the natural order of things. What differentiates societies and beings within societies is what they define as pleasurable. If a society is structured largely around pleasures of the body, it is operating at a different level from a society structured around pleasures of the soul. And understand, too, that this does not mean that your Puritans were right, and that all pleasures of the body should be denied. It means that in elevated societies, pleasures of the physical body do not make up the largest number of pleasures which are enjoyed. They are not the prime focus. The more elevated a society or being, the more elevated are its pleasures.
Wait a minute. That sounds like such a value judgment. I thought that you, God, didn't make value judgments.
Is it a value judgment to say that Mount Everest is higher than Mount McKinley? Is it a value judgment to say that Aunt Sarah is older than her nephew Tommy? Are these value judgments or observations? I have not said it is better to be elevated in one's consciousness. In fact, it is not, any more than it is better to be in fourth grade than in first. I am simply observing what fourth grade is.
And we are not in fourth grade on this planet. We are in first. Is that it?
My child. You are not yet even in kindergarten. You are in nursery school.
Now, how can I not hear that as an insult? Why does it sound to me as if you're putting the human race down?
Because you are deeply ego-invested in being something you are not, and in not being what you are. Most people hear insults when only an observation has been made, if what is being observed is something they don't want to own. Yet until you hold a thing, you cannot let it go. And you cannot disown that which you have never owned.
You cannot change that which you do not accept.
Precisely. Enlightenment begins with acceptance, without judgment of what is. This is known as moving into the isness. It is in the isness where freedom will be found. What you resist persists. What you look at disappears. That is, it ceases to have its illusory form. You see it for what it is. And what is can always be changed. It is only what is not that cannot be changed. Therefore, to change the isness, move into it. Do not resist it. Do not deny it. What you deny, you declare. What you declare, you create. Denial of something is recreation of it, for the very act of denying something places it there. Acceptance of something places you in control of it. That which you deny, you cannot control, for you have said it is not there. Therefore, what you deny controls you. The majority of your race does not want to accept that you have not yet evolved to kindergarten. It does not want to accept that the human race is still in nursery school. Yet this lack of acceptance is exactly what keeps it there. You are so deeply ego-invested in being what you are not, highly evolved, that you are not being what you are, evolving. You are thus working against yourself, fighting yourself, and hence evolving very slowly. The fast track of evolution begins with admitting and accepting what is, not what is not.
And I will know that I have accepted what is when I no longer feel insulted as I hear it described.
Exactly. Are you insulted if I say you have blue eyes? So now I tell you this. The more elevated a society or being, the more elevated are its pleasures. What you call pleasure is what declares your level of evolution.
Help me, will you, with this term elevated? What do you mean by that?
Your being is the universe in microcosm. You and your whole physical body are composed of raw energy, clustered around seven centers or chakras. Study the chakra centers and what they mean. There are hundreds of books written about this. This is wisdom I have given the human race before. What is pleasurable or stimulates your lower chakras is not the same as what is pleasurable to your higher chakras. The higher you raise the energy of life through your physical being, the more elevated will be your consciousness.
Well, here we go again. That seems to argue for celibacy. That seems to be the whole argument against expression of sexual passion. People who are elevated in their consciousness don't come from their root chakra, their first or lowest chakra, in their interactions with other humans.
That's true.
But I thought you've said throughout this dialogue that human sexuality was to be celebrated, not repressed.
And that is correct.
Well, help me out here then, will you? Because we seem to have a contradiction here.
The world is full of contradictions, my son.
Mm.
Lack of contradictions is not a necessary ingredient in truth. Sometimes greater truth lies within the contradiction. What we have here is divine dichotomy.
Well, then help me understand the dichotomy, because all my life I've heard about how desirable it was, how elevated it was to raise the kundalini energy out of the root chakra. This has been the chief justification for mystics living lives of sexless ecstasy. I realize we've gotten off the subject of death here, and I apologize for dragging us into this unrelated territory.
What are you apologizing for? A conversation goes where a conversation goes. The topic we are on in this whole dialogue is what it means to be fully human. And what life is about in this universe. That is the only topic, and this falls within that. Wanting to know about death is wanting to know about life, a point I made earlier. And if our exchanges lead to an expansion of our inquiry to include the very act which creates life and celebrates it magnificently, so be it. Now let's get clear again about one thing. It is not a requirement of the highly evolved that all sexual expression be muted. And all sexual energy be elevated. If that were true, then there would be no highly evolved beings anywhere because all evolution would have stopped.
A rather obvious point.
Yes. And so anyone who says that the very holiest people never have sex and that this is a sign of their holiness does not understand how life was meant to work. Let me put this in very clear terms. If you want a yardstick with which to judge whether a thing is good for the human race or not, ask yourself a simple question. What would happen if everyone did it? This is a very easy measure and a very accurate one. If everyone did a thing and the result was of ultimate benefit to the human race, then that is evolved. If everyone did it and it brought disaster to the human race, then that is not a very elevated thing to recommend. Do you agree?
Of course.
Then you've just agreed that no real master will ever say that sexual celibacy is the path to mastery. Yet it is this idea that sexual abstinence is somehow the higher way and that sexual expression is a lower desire that has shamed the sexual experience and caused all manner of guilt and dysfunction to develop around it.
Yet if the reasoning against sexual abstinence is that it would prohibit procreation, couldn't it be argued that once sex has served this function, there's no more need for it?
One does not engage in sex because one realizes one's responsibility to the human race to procreate. One engages in sex because it is the natural thing to do. It is built into the genes. You obey a biological imperative.
Precisely. It's a genetic signal that drives to the question of species survival. But once the survival of the species is assured, isn't it the elevated thing to do to ignore the signal?
To misinterpret the signal. The biological imperative is not to guarantee the survival of the species, but to experience the oneness, which is the true nature of your being. Creating new life is what happens when oneness is achieved, but is not the reason oneness is sought. If procreation were the only reason for sexual expression, if it were nothing more than a delivery system, you would no longer need to engage in it with one another. You can unite the chemical elements of life in a petri dish. Yet this would not satisfy the most basic urges of the soul, which, it turns out, are much larger than mere procreation, but have to do with recreation of who and what you really are. The biological imperative is not to create more life, but to experience more life, and to experience that life as it really is, a manifestation of oneness.
That's why you never stop people from having sex, even though they've long ago stopped having children.
Of course.
Yet some say that sex should stop when people stop having children, and that those couples who continue with this activity are just caving into base physical urges.
Yes.
And that this is not elevated, but merely animalistic behavior beneath the more noble nature of man.
Well, this gets us back to the subject of chakras or energy centers. I said earlier that the higher you raise the energy of life through your physical being, the more elevated will be your consciousness.
Yes, and that seems to say no sex.
No, it does not. Not when you understand it. Let me go back to your previous comment and make something clear. There is nothing ignoble or unholy about having sex. You've got to get that idea out of your mind and out of your culture. There is nothing base or gross or less than dignified, much less sanctified, about a passionate, desire-filled sexual experience. Physical urges are not manifestations of animalistic behavior. Those physical urges were built into the system by me. Who do you suppose created it that way? Yet physical urges are but one ingredient in a complex mixture of responses that you all have to each other. Remember, you are a three-part being with seven chakra centers. When you respond to one another from all three parts and all seven centers at the same time, then you have the peak experience you are looking for that you have been created for. And there is nothing unholy about any of these energies, yet if you choose just one of them, that is unholy. It is not being whole. When you are not being whole, you are being less than yourself. That is what is meant by unholy.
Wow, I get it, I get it.
The admonition against sex for those who choose to be elevated was never an admonition for me. It was an invitation. An invitation is not an admonition, yet you have made it so. And the invitation was not to stop having sex, but to stop being unwhole. Whatever you are doing, having sex or having breakfast, going to work or walking on the beach, jumping rope or reading a good book, whatever you are doing, do it as a whole being, as the whole being you are. If you are having sex from only your lower chakra center, You are operating from the root chakra alone and missing by far the most glorious part of the experience. Yet if you are being loving with another person and coming from all seven energy centers while you are being that, now you are having a peak experience. How can this not be holy?
It can't. I'm unable to imagine such an experience, not being holy.
And so the invitation to raise the life energy through your physical being to the top chakra was never meant to be a suggestion or a demand that you disconnect from the bottom. If you have raised the energy to your heart chakra, or even to your crown chakra, that doesn't mean it cannot be in your root chakra as well. Indeed, if it is not, you are disconnected. When you have raised the life energy to your higher centers, you may or may not choose to have what you would call a sexual experience with another. But if you do not, it will not be because to do so would be to violate some cosmic law on holiness, nor will it make you somehow more elevated. And if you do choose to be sexual with another, it will not lower you to a root chakra only level unless you do the opposite of disconnecting at the bottom and disconnect from the top. So here is the invitation, not an admonition, but an invitation. Raise your energy, your life force, to the highest level possible in every moment, and you will be elevated. This has nothing to do with having sex or not having sex. It has to do with raising your consciousness no matter what you are doing.
I get it. I understand. Although I don't know how to raise my consciousness, I don't think I know how to raise the life energy through my chakra centers, and I'm not sure most people even know what these centers are.
Anyone who earnestly wishes to know more about the physiology of spirituality can find out easily enough. I have sourced this information before in very clear terms.
You mean in other books, through other writers?
Yes, read the writings of Deepak Chopra. He is one of the clearest enunciators right now on your planet. He understands the mystery of spirituality and the science of it. And there are other wonderful messengers as well. Their books describe not only how to raise your life force up through your body, but also how to leave your physical body. You can remember through these additional readings how joyous it is letting the body go. Then you will understand how it could be that you might never again fear death. You will understand the dichotomy, how it is a joy to be with the body and a joy to be free of it.
You know, life must be kind of like school. I can remember being excited every fall about the first day of school, and at the end of the year, thrilled to be getting out.
Precisely. Exactly. You've hit it. That's it. Exactly. Only life is not a school.
Yes, I remember. You explained all of that in Book One. Until then, I thought life was a school, and that we had to come here to learn our lessons. You helped me tremendously in Book One to see that this was a false doctrine.
I'm glad. That's what we're trying to do here with this trilogy, bring you to clarity. And now you're clear about why and how the soul can be overjoyed after death without necessarily ever regretting life. But you asked a larger question before, and we should revisit it.
I'm sorry?
You said, if the soul is so unhappy in the body, why doesn't it just leave?
Oh, yes.
Well, it does. And I don't mean only at death, as I just explained. But it does not leave because it is unhappy. Rather, it leaves because it wishes to regenerate, rejuvenate.
Does it do this often?
Every day.
The soul leaves the body every day? When?
When the soul yearns for its larger experience. It finds this experience rejuvenating.
It just leaves?
Yes. The soul leaves your body all the time. Continually, throughout your life. That is why we invented sleep.
Oh, the soul leaves the body during sleep?
Of course, that is what sleep is. Periodically throughout your life, the soul seeks rejuvenation, refueling, if you will, so that it can continue lumbering along in this carrier you call your body. Do you think it is easy for your soul to inhabit your body? It is not. It may be simple, but it is not easy. It is a joy, but it is not easy. It is the most difficult thing your soul has ever done. The soul, which knows a lightness and a freedom which you can't imagine, yearns for that state of being again, just as a child who loves school can yearn for summer vacation. just as an adult who yearns for company can also, while having company, yearn to be alone. The soul seeks the true state of being. The soul is lightness and freedom. It is also peace and joy. It is also limitlessness and painlessness, perfect wisdom, perfect love. It is all these things and more. Yet it experiences precious few of these things while it is with the body. And so it made an arrangement with itself. It told itself it would stay with the body as long as it needs to in order to create and experience itself as it now chooses, but only if it could leave the body whenever it wished. It does this daily. Through the experience you call sleep.
Sleep? Is the experience of the soul leaving the body?
Yes.
Well, I thought we fell asleep because the body needed rest.
You are mistaken. It is the other way around. The soul seeks the rest, and so causes the body to fall asleep. The soul literally drops the body, so that's right where it is standing. When it is tired of the limits, tired of the heaviness and lack of freedom of being with the body, it will just leave the body when it seeks refueling, when it becomes weary of all the non-truth and false reality and imagined dangers, and when it seeks once again reconnection, reassurance, restfulness, and reawakening for the mind. When the soul first embraces a body, it finds the experience extremely difficult. It is very tiring, particularly for a newly arriving soul. That is why babies sleep a lot. When the soul gets over the initial shock of being attached to a body once more, it begins to increase its tolerance for that. It stays with it more. At the same time, the part of you called your mind moves into forgetfulness just as it was designed to do. Even the soul's flights out of the body, taken now on a less frequent, but still usually daily, basis, do not always bring the mind back to remembrance. Indeed, during these times, the soul may be free, but the mind may be confused. Thus, the whole being may ask, where am I? What am I creating here? These searchings may lead to fitful journeys, even frightening ones. You call these trips nightmares. Sometimes just the opposite will occur. The soul will arrive at a place of great remembering. Now the mind will have an awakening. This will fill it with peace and joy, which you will experience in your body when you return to it. The more your whole being experiences the reassurance of these rejuvenations, and the more it remembers what it is doing and trying to do with the body, the less your soul will choose to stay away from the body. For now it knows that it came to the body for a reason and with a purpose. Its desire is to get on with that and to make best use of all the time with the body that it has. The person of great wisdom needs little sleep.
Are you saying that you can tell how evolved a person is by how much sleep that person needs?
Almost, yes. You could almost say that. Sometimes the soul chooses to leave the body just for the sheer joy of it, though. It may not be seeking reawakening for the mind or rejuvenation for the body. It may simply be choosing to recreate the sheer ecstasy of knowing the oneness. So it would not always be valid to say that the more sleep a person gets, the less evolved that person is. Still, it is not a coincidence that as beings become more and more aware of what they are doing with their bodies, and that they are not their bodies, but that which is with their bodies, they become willing and able to spend more and more time with their bodies, and thus appear to need less sleep. Now, some beings even choose to experience both the forgetfulness of being with the body and the oneness of the soul at once. These beings can train a part of themselves to not identify with the body while they are still with the body, thus experiencing the ecstasy of knowing who they really are without having to lose human wakefulness in order to do it.
How do they do this? How can I do this?
It is a question of awareness, of reaching a state of total awareness, as I said before. You cannot do totally aware. You can only be totally aware.
How? There must be some tools you can give me.
Daily meditation is one of the best tools with which to create this experience. With it, you can raise your life energy to the highest chakra and even leave your body while you are awake. In meditation, you place yourself in a state of readiness to experience total awareness while your body is in a awakened state. This state of readiness is called true wakefulness. You do not have to be sitting in meditation to experience this. Meditation is simply a device, a tool, as you put it. But you do not have to do sitting meditation in order to experience this. You should also know that sitting meditation is not the only kind of meditation there is. There's also stopping meditation, walking meditation, doing meditation, sexual meditation. This is the state of true wakefulness. When you stop in this state, simply stop in your tracks. Stop going where you are going. Stop doing what you are doing. Just stop for a moment and just be right where you are. You become right exactly where you are. Stopping even just for a moment can be blessed. You look around slowly and you notice things you did not notice while you were passing them by. The deep snow of the earth just after it rains. A curl of hair over the left ear of your beloved. That's really good it feels to see a child at play. You don't have to leave your body to experience this. This is the state of true wakefulness. When you walk in this state, you breathe in every flower. You fly with every bird. You feel every crunch beneath your feet. You find beauty and wisdom, for wisdom is found wherever beauty is formed. And beauty is formed everywhere, out of all the stuff of life. You do not have to seek it. It will come to you. And you don't have to leave your body to experience this. This is the state of true wakefulness. When you do in this state, you turn whatever you are doing into a meditation and thus into a gift, an offering from you to your soul and from your soul to the all. Washing dishes, you enjoy the warmth of the water caressing your hands and marvel at the wonder of both water and warmth. Working at your computer, you see the words appear on the screen in front of you in response to the command of your fingers, and exhilarate over the power of the mind and body when it is harnessed to do your bidding. Preparing dinner, you feel the love of the universe which brought you this nourishment, and as your return gift, pour into the making of this meal all the love of your being. It does not matter how extravagant or how simple the meal is. Soup can be loved into deliciousness. You don't have to leave your body to experience this. This is the state of true wakefulness. When you experience sexual energy exchange in this state, you know the highest truth of who you are. The heart of your lover becomes your home. The body of your lover becomes your own. Your soul no longer imagines itself separate from anything. You don't have to leave your body to experience this. This is the state of true wakefulness.
When you are in readiness, you are in wakefulness. A smile can take you there, a simple smile. Just stop everything for one moment and smile at nothing, just because it feels good, just because your heart knows the secret, and because your soul knows what the secret is. Smile at that. Smile a lot. It will cure whatever ails you. You are asking me for tools, and I am giving them to you. Breathe. That is another tool. Breathe long and deep. Breathe slowly and gently. Breathe in the soft, sweet nothingness of life, so full of energy, so full of love. It is God's love you are breathing. Breathe deeply, and you can feel it. Breathe very, very deeply, and the love will make you cry. For joy, for you have met your God, and your God has introduced you to your soul. Once this experience has taken place, life is never the same. People talk of having been to the mountaintop or having slipped into sublime ecstasy. Their beingness is changed forever.
Thank you. I understand. It's the simple things, the simple acts, and the purest.
Yes, but know this. Some people meditate for years and never experience this. It has to do with how open one is, how willing, and also how able to move away from any expectation.
Should I meditate every day?
Well, as in all things, there are no shoulds or shouldn'ts here. It is not a question of what you should do, but what you choose to do. Some souls seek to walk in awareness. Some recognize that in this life, most people are sleepwalking, unconscious. They are going through life without consciousness. Yet souls who walk in awareness choose a different path. They choose another way. They seek to experience all the peace and joy, limitlessness and freedom, wisdom and love that oneness brings, not just when they have dropped the body and it has fallen asleep, but when they have risen the body up. It is said of a soul which creates such an experience, he is risen. Others in the so-called New Age term this a process of consciousness raising. It doesn't matter what terms you use. Words are the least reliable form of communication. It all comes down to living in awareness. And then it becomes total awareness. And what is it of which you eventually become totally aware? You eventually become totally aware of who you are. Daily meditation is one way you may achieve this, yet it requires commitment, dedication, a decision to seek inner experience, not outer reward. And remember, the silences hold the secrets. And so the sweetest sound is the sound of silence. This is the song of the soul. If you believe the noises of the world rather than the silences of your soul, you will be lost.
So daily meditation is a good idea.
A good idea, yes. Yet know again what I have just said here. The song of the soul may be sung many ways. The sweet sound of silence may be heard many times. Some hear the silence in prayer. Some sing the song in their work. Some seek the secrets in quiet contemplation, others in less contemplative surroundings. When mastery is reached, or even intermittently experienced, the noises of the world can be muffled, the distractions quieted, even in the midst of them. All of life becomes a meditation. All of life is a meditation in which you are contemplating the divine. This is called true wakefulness or mindfulness. Experienced in this way, everything in life is blessed. There is struggle and pain and worry no more. There is only experience, which you may choose to label in any way you wish. You may choose to label all of it perfection. So use your life as a meditation and all the events in it. Walk in wakefulness, not as one asleep. Move with mindfulness, not mindlessly. And do not tarry in doubt and fear, neither in guilt nor self-recrimination, yet reside in permanent splendor in the assurance that you are grandly loved. You are always one with me. You are forever welcome. Welcome home. For your home is in my heart. And mine in yours. I invite you to see this in life as you will surely see it in death. Then you will know that there is no death, and that what you have called life and death are both part of the same unending experience. We are all that is, all that ever was, and all that ever will be. World without end.
I love you. Do you know that?
Yes. And I love you. Do you know that?
I'm starting to. I'm really starting to.
Good.
Will you tell me some things about the soul, please?
Sure. I'll try to explain within your limited realm of understanding, but do not allow yourself to become frustrated if certain things don't make sense to you. Try to remember that you're bringing this information through a unique filter, a filter which has been designed by you to shield you from too much remembering.
Remind me again why I did that.
The game would be over if you remembered everything. You came here for a particular reason, and your divine purpose would be thwarted if you understood how everything is put together. Some things will always remain a mystery at this level of consciousness, and it is right that they should. So do not try to solve all the mysteries, not at one time anyway. Give the universe a chance. It will unfold itself in due course. Enjoy the experience of becoming.
Make haste slowly.
Exactly.
My father used to say that.
Your father was a wise and wonderful man.
Not many people would describe him that way.
Not many people knew him.
My mother did.
Yes, she did.
And she loved him.
Yes, she did.
And she forgave him.
Yes, she did.
For all of his behaviors that were hurtful.
Yes. She understood and loved and forgave. And in this she was and is a wonderful model, a blessed teacher.
Yes. So, will you tell me about the soul?
I will. What do you want to know?
Let's start with the first and obvious question. I already know the answer, but it gives us a starting point. Is there such a thing as the human soul?
Yes. It is the third aspect of your being. You are a three-part being made up of body, mind, and spirit.
Well, I know where my body is. I can see that. And I think I know where my mind is. It's in the part of my body called my head, but I'm not sure I have any idea where my...
Wait a minute. Hold it. You're wrong about something. Your mind is not in your head.
It's not?
No. Your brain is in your skull. Your mind is not.
Well, where is it, then?
In every cell of your body.
Whoa.
What you call the mind is really an energy. It is thought, and thought is an energy, not an object. Your brain is an object. It is a physical, biochemical mechanism, the largest, most sophisticated, but not the only mechanism in the human body with which the body translates or converts the energy, which is your thought, into physical impulses. Your brain is a transformer. So is your whole body. You have little transformers in every cell. Biochemists have often remarked at how individual cells, blood cells, for instance, seem to have their own intelligence. They do, in fact.
That goes not just for cells, but for larger parts of the body. Every man on the planet knows about a particular body part that often seems to have a mind of its own.
Yes, and every woman knows how absurd men become when that is the body part they allow to influence their choices and decisions.
Some women use that knowledge to control men.
Undeniable. And some men control women through choices and decisions made from that place.
Undeniable.
Want to know how to stop the circus?
Absolutely.
This is what was meant earlier by all that talk about raising the energy of life to include all seven chakra centers. When your choices and decisions come from a place larger than the limited locale you have described, it is impossible for women to control you, and you would never seek to control them. The only reason that women would ever resort to such means of manipulation and control is that there seems to be no other means of control, at least none nearly as effective. And without some means of control, men often become, well, uncontrollable. Yet if men would demonstrate more of their higher nature, and if women would appeal more to that part of men, the so-called battle of the sexes would be over, as would most other battles of any kind on your planet. As I have said earlier, this does not mean men and women should give up sex or that sex is part of a human being's lower nature. It means that sexual energy alone, when not raised to higher chakras and combined with the other energies that make one a whole person, produces choices and outcomes that do not reflect the whole person. These are often less than magnificent. The whole of you is magnificence itself. Yet anything less than the whole of you is less than magnificent. So if you want to guarantee that you'll produce a less than magnificent choice or outcome, make a decision from your root chakra center only. Then watch the results. They are as predictable as can be.
I think I knew that.
Of course you did. The largest question facing the human race is not when will you learn, but when will you act on what you've already learned.
So the mind is in every cell?
Yes. And there are more cells in your brain than anywhere else. So it seems as though your mind is there. Yet that is just the main processing center, not the only one.
Good, I'm clear. So where is the soul?
What do you think it is?
I don't know. Behind the third eye?
No.
In the middle of my chest? To the right of my heart? Just beneath the breastbone?
No.
Okay, I give up.
It is everywhere.
Everywhere?
Everywhere.
Carl, like the mind.
Oops. Wait a minute. The mind is not everywhere.
It's not? I thought you just said it was in every cell of the body.
That is not everywhere. There are spaces between the cells. In fact, your body is 99% space.
Ah, this is where the soul is?
The soul is everywhere, in, through, and around you. It is that which contains you.
Wait a minute. Now, you just wait a minute. I was always taught that the body is the container of my soul. Whatever happened to your body is the temple of your being.
A figure of speech.
Huh?
It's useful in helping people to understand that they are more than their bodies, that there is something larger that they are. There is, literally. The soul is larger than the body. It is not carried within the body, but carries the body within it.
I hear you, but I'm still having a hard time picturing this.
Have you ever heard of an aura?
Yes. Is this the soul?
It is as close as we can come in your language and your understanding to giving you a picture of an enormous and complex reality. The soul is that which holds you together, just as the soul of God is that which contains the universe and holds it together.
Wow. This is a complete reversal of everything I've ever thought.
Hang on, my son. The reversals have just begun.
But if the soul is, in a sense, the air in and around us, and if everyone else's soul is the same, where does one soul end and another begin? Don't tell me.
You see, you already know the answer.
There is no place where another soul ends and ours begins. Just like there's no place where the air in the living room stops and the air in the dining room starts. It's all the same air. It's all the same soul.
You've just discovered the secret of the universe.
And if you are that which contains the universe, just as we are that which contains our bodies, then there's no place where you end and we begin. And you can clear your throat all you want, but for me, this is a miraculous revelation. I mean, I knew I always understood this, but now I understand it.
That's great. Isn't that great?
You see, my problem with understanding in the past had to do with the fact that the body is a discrete container, making it possible to differentiate between, well, this body and that body. And since I always thought that the soul was housed in the body, I therefore differentiated between this soul and that soul.
Quite naturally, yes.
But if the soul is everywhere, inside and outside the body, in its aura, as you put it, then when does one aura end and another begin? And now I'm able to see for the first time, I mean for the first time really in physical terms, how it's possible that one soul does not end and another begin. And that it is physically true that we are all one.
Yippee! That's all I can say. Yippee!
I always thought that was a metaphysical truth. Now I see that it's a physical truth. Holy smoke! Religion has just become science.
Don't say I didn't tell you so.
Wait a minute. If there's no place where one soul ends and another begins, does that mean there's no such thing as an individual soul?
Well, yes and no.
An answer truly befitting God.
Thank you.
But frankly, I was hoping for a little more clarity.
Give me a break here. We're moving so fast.
Yes, we are.
So let's just catch our breath here.
Okay.
Everybody relax. I'm going to explain it all to you.
Okay, go ahead. I'm ready.
You remember how I've talked to you many times now about what I've called divine dichotomy. Well, this is one of them. In fact, it's the biggest one.
I see.
It's important to learn about divine dichotomy and understand it thoroughly if you are to live in our universe with grace. Divine dichotomy holds that it is possible for two apparently contradictory truths to exist simultaneously in the same space. Now, in your planet, people find this difficult to accept. They like to have order, and anything that does not fit into their picture is automatically rejected. For this reason, when two realities begin to assert themselves, and they seem to contradict one another, the immediate assumption is that one of them must be wrong, false, untrue. It takes a great deal of maturity to see and accept that, in fact, they might both be true. Yet in the realm of the absolute, as opposed to the realm of the relative in which you live. It is very clear that the one truth, which is all there is, sometimes produces an effect which, viewed in relative terms, looks like a contradiction. This is called a divine dichotomy. And it is a very real part of the human experience. And as I've said, it's virtually impossible to live gracefully without accepting this. One is always grumbling, angry, thrashing about, vainly seeking justice, or earnestly trying to reconcile opposing forces which were never meant to be reconciled, but which, by the very nature of the tension between them, produce exactly the desired effect. The realm of the relative is, in fact, held together by just such tension. As an example, the tension between good and evil. In ultimate reality, there is no such thing as good and evil. In the realm of the absolute, all there is love. Yet in the realm of the relative, you have created the experience of what you call evil. And you have done it for a very sound reason. You wanted to experience love. Not just know that love is all there is, and you cannot experience something when there is nothing else but that. And so, you created in your reality, and continue to do so every day. A polarity of good and evil, thus using one so that you might experience the other. And here we have a divine dichotomy, two seemingly contradictory truths existing simultaneously in the same place. Specifically, there is such a thing as good and evil. All there is love.
Thank you. Thank you for explaining this to me. You've touched on this before, but thank you for helping me understand divine dichotomy even better.
You're welcome. Now, as I said, the greatest divine dichotomy is the one we're looking at now. There's only one being, and hence only one soul. And there are many souls in the one being. Here's how the dichotomy works. You've just had it explained to you that there is no separation between souls. The soul is the energy of life that exists within and around as the aura of all physical objects. In a sense, it is that which is holding all physical objects in place. The soul of God holds in the universe. The soul of man holds in each individual human body.
So the body is not a container, a housing for the soul. The soul is a container for the body.
That's right.
Yet there are no dividing lines between souls. There's no place where one soul ends and another begins. And so it's really one soul holding all bodies.
Correct.
Yet the one soul feels like a bunch of individual souls.
Indeed it does. Indeed I do. By design.
Can you explain how it works?
Yes. While there is no actual separation between souls, it is true that the stuff of which the one soul is made manifests in physical reality at different speeds, producing different degrees of density.
Wait a minute. Different speeds? When did speed come in?
All of life is a vibration. That which you call life, you could just as easily call it God, is pure energy. That energy is vibrating constantly, always. It is moving in waves. The waves vibrate at different speeds, producing differing degrees of density or light. This in turn produces what you would call different effects in the physical world. Actually, different physical objects. And while the objects are different and discrete, the energy which produces them is exactly the same. Let me go back to the example that you used of the air between your living room and dining room. It was a good use of imagery that just popped right out of you. An inspiration.
From guess where?
Yes, I gave it to you. Now, you said there was no specific place between those two physical locations where the air of the living room stopped and the air of the dining room began.
Yeah.
That is true. Yet there is a place where the air of the living room becomes less dense. That is, it dissipates, becomes thinner. So, too, the air of the dining room. The further from the dining room you go, the less you smell dinner. Now, the air in the house is the same air. There is no separate air in the dining room. Yet the air in the dining room sure seems like other air. For one thing, it smells different. So because the air has taken on different characteristics, it seems as though it is different air. But it is not. It is all the same air, seeming different. In the living room, you smell the fireplace. In the dining room, you smell dinner. You might even go into one room and say, "Phew, it's stuffy. Let's get some air in here." As if there was no air at all. And yet, of course, there's plenty of air. What you are wanting to do is change its characteristics. So you bring in some air from the outside. Yet that is the same air, too. There's only one air moving in, around, and through everything.
This is cool. This is really cool. I mean, I totally get this. I love the way you explain the universe to me in ways I can totally get.
Well, thank you. I'm trying here. So let me go on.
Please, please.
Like the air in your house, the energy of life, what we'll call the soul of God, takes on different characteristics as it surrounds different physical objects. Indeed, that energy coalesces in a particular way to form those objects. As particles of energy join together to form physical matter, they become very concentrated, mashed up, pushed together. They begin to look like, even feel like, distinct units. That is, they begin to seem separate, different from all the other energy. Yet this is all the same energy behaving differently. It is this very act of behaving differently which makes it possible for that which is all to manifest as that which is many. As I explained in Book 1, that which is could not experience itself as what it is until it developed this ability to differentiate. So that which is all separated into that which is this and that which is that. I'm trying to make this very simple now.
Thank you.
The clumps of energy which coalesced into discrete units that held in physical beings are what you have chosen to call souls. Parts of me that have become the lot of you are what we are talking about here. Thus, the divine dichotomy. There is only one of us. There are many of us.
Whoa, this is great.
You're telling me? Shall I go on?
No, stop here. I'm bored. Yes, go on.
Okay. Now, as energy coalesces, it becomes, as I said, very concentrated. But the further one moves from the point of this concentration, the more dissipated the energy becomes. The air becomes thinner. The aura fades. The energy never completely disappears because it cannot. It is the stuff of which everything is made. It's all there is. Yet it can become very, very thin, very subtle, almost not there. Then, in another place, read that another part of itself. It can again coalesce, once more clumping together to form what you call matter, and what looks like a discrete unit. Now the two units appear separate from each other, and in truth, there is no separation at all. This is, in very, very simple, elementary terms, the explanation behind the whole physical universe.
Oh, but can it be true? How do I know I haven't just made this all up?
Your scientists are already discovering that the building blocks of all of life are the same. They brought back rocks from the moon and found the same stuff they find in trees. They take apart a tree and find the same stuff they find in you. I tell you this, we are all the same stuff. We are all the same energy, coalesced, compressed in different ways to create different forms and different matter. Nothing matters in and of itself. That is, nothing can become matter all by itself. Jesus said, "Without the Father, I am nothing." The Father of all is pure thought. This is the energy of life. This is what you have chosen to call absolute love. This is the God and the Goddess, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. It is the all in all, the unmoved mover, the prime source. It is that which you have sought to understand from the beginning of time. The great mystery, the endless enigma, the eternal truth. There is only one of us, and so it is that which you are.